Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. 'Tis that season. Holiday shopping lists are growing across the land. A year's worth of good and not so good books sit in piles on nightstands from coast to coast. Time for us to stop and savor the books that moved our hearts or changed our minds this year. Books we may be giving to friends and family. This hour, On Point, we sit down with three great readers to talk about the best books of 09. You can join the conversation. What book tops your list this year? Is there a heartbreaking work of staggering genius you're dying to tell the world about? What's moved you? You can also give us your best suggestions at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. We have readers from right across the country with us today. David Ulan joins us from Palm Springs, California. He's the Los Angeles Times book editor and a member of the board of directors of the National Book Critics Circle. David Ulan, thanks very much for being here.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here.
From Louisville, Kentucky, we're joined by Carol Bessie. She's co-owner of Louisville's own Carmichael's Bookstores, chosen Bookstore of the Year this year by Publishers Weekly. Carol Bessie, welcome to you as well.
Hello, Tom. I'm delighted to be with you, representing the heartland.
Yes, absolutely, and great to have you from there. And finally, from New York, Laura Miller joins us. She's book critic for Salon.com, editor of the Salon.com Reader's Guide to Contemporary Authors. Laura Miller, thank you so much for joining us today.
It's great to be with you.
All right, we're going to get to your list. You've all got them, and we're eager to hear what's on them. But first, a couple of things. David, first to you. In August, you wrote an essay saying that you can't even read anymore. You're having problems sitting down and reading. We've got to understand what's up with that.
I think for me it's the susceptibility to an over-networked culture and to sort of the buzz of empty implication. I think, you know, we live in a world where there's a lot of noise and reading requires a lot of silence. At the I was at an event in September in New York for National Book Critics Circle 35th anniversary where E.L. Doctorow said that, you know, basically reading and writing, the writer creates something in silence for a reader to read in silence. And I think we live in a culture at the moment where silence is really difficult to find. So what I had found was that it's increasingly tough if you work a full-time job and you're on the internet a lot and reading sort of little bits and pieces all day to kind of quiet your mind. But I also think that is exactly what makes it even more essential for sanity's sake, on the one hand, and also, I think, for kind of some level of cultural contemplation.
Even you, the reader, having trouble carving out that time. But as you say, maybe that makes the time all the more valuable when we do find it. But we'll keep that in mind, all of our listeners. No doubt, some having that same challenge. Laura Miller, on your front at Salon.com, you're dropping book reviews, as I understand it. What's up with that?
Well, we're not dropping book reviews, but we are sort of writing about books in a slightly different way.
Dropping old-fashioned book reviews, then, perhaps I should say. What's it mean?
The old premise was basically that a book editor like David, who is an excellent book editor, I might add, has to sort of figure out, you know, has to pick a reviewer to go with the book. And we're sort of moving towards having the person who's writing about the book, that would be me, choosing the book from a number of selections so that you only wind up writing about the book if you're really enthusiastic about it.
So you're not just assigning a book to some reviewer who may or may not be interested, and you get the traditional review, but you will still be focusing on books and what you can recommend.
Oh, absolutely. That is my entire job, is writing about books. So we aren't going to stop writing about books, but the focus is going to be more on helping people find books that we really love, rather than the kind of, on the one hand, on the other hand, more sort of namby-pamby-ish sort of take that you get from a lot of book reviews, which tends to make books sound not very exciting.
All right. There's another angle. And Carol Bessie, I mean, there you are in Louisville. Tell us
I mean, overall, are books moving off the shelves of bookstores these days? Up, down, sideways? How are sales? Are people buying in these economic times?
At our store, things are really going well. I think it's in part because we have established a community of readers over the course of 30 years. But I would like to really endorse what Laura Miller is talking about doing at Salon, because that's what we do every day in our stores, is we find books that we love and we recommend them to readers.
Straight up, not necessarily a whole lot of review, but a straight recommendation, you'll like this.
That's exactly right.
You
don't want to put a book in the hands of a reader that they're not going to enjoy. So,
do you see changes in taste this year, Carol, in terms of what people are picking up? Either, I don't know, are they looking for the paperback that came out 5 years ago because it's a little cheaper, or changes in subject matter? Do you see trends in terms of what people are going for?
People are always loving paperbacks, and the publishers are beginning to respond to that and printing some very literary works in what's called trade paperback originals. So they don't come out in hardcover first. They come out in paperback, which makes them accessible to a much wider audience. In fact, I think two of the books on my list were paperback originals. So that's a big change.
I want to get to the list, if we may, just because the time will go, and I'm sure people will like to hear. Laura, let me come first to you, and maybe on the fiction side, what are the top couple of books on your fiction list, Laura?
Well, I really liked a book called Chronic City by Jonathan Lethem, who is a writer best known for writing about Brooklyn, but this is his first Manhattan novel. And to me, it is kind of like the first sort of big novel of maybe sort of the next decade, because it's a lot about what it's like to live in a world full of things that are simulations of reality, and not being entirely sure what is real or how real you are yourself. And also, I think it's probably the great Manhattan novel of our time. To me, as someone who lives here, I feel like people think about New York a lot, and they think they know it, but usually their idea of it is about 20 years out of date. And this, to me, just felt very immediate and real.
Jonathan Lethem, Chronic City. You've got Friendship and Real Estate among the rich and rent-controlled.
The rent-controlled apartment. a vanishing phenomenon.
in New York. How about you, Carol? The top of your fiction list.
I absolutely loved Chris Cleave's Little Bee. Little Bee is horrifying and hilarious at the same time, which is a pretty strange combination. It's about a Nigerian refugee who lands in London and reconnects with a woman that she had had an encounter with in Nigeria years before, and how their two lives become intertwined. It's beautiful. It's funny, charming, but it deals with some very serious issues. Refugees, the damage done to the third world by corporations and those that they employ.
And you've got a little reading from it that might give us a sense of how it's elegant at the same time serious. This is Little Bee by Chris Cleave, and I guess this must be the 16-year-old orphan at the center of the story talking about a scar.
That's exactly right.
Could you read?
This is from Little Bee. I ask you right here, please, to agree with me that a scar is never ugly. That is what the scar makers want us to think. But you and I, we must make an agreement to defy them. We must see all scars as beauty. Okay? This will be our secret. Because take it from me, a scar does not form on the dying. A scar means I survived.
A scar means I've survived, and we know we're going somewhere right there. David Ulin, what about the top of your fiction list this year?
I think the book I liked the most, work of fiction I liked the most, was Lydia Millett's collection of short stories, Love and Infant Monkeys. Which,
that's on my list, too.
Yes.
She's a superb writer who is just woefully under-recognized.
Love and in Infant Monkeys. Is there a theme to these short stories?
It's a collection of short stories. This will sound strange, but believe me, it works. About the intersection of celebrities and animals. So that, you know, for instance, there's stories, you know, in one story, Madonna goes hunting. There's a story where someone runs into Noam Chomsky at the Wellfleet town dump.
Oh, boy.
She takes these kind of constructed situations, but then uses them to really get at I think, some really important and telling observations about the nature of who we are, of how we live, of, you know, the way that humans and human society intersects with the natural world. It's just exquisite in this very kind of quiet, subtle way. And she's a writer who I just have had my eye on for a while and think everybody should be reading.
Laura Miller, we've just got a minute before the break, but you've got a small reading from Love and Infant Monkeys. Can we hear it?
I do.
By Lydia Millett?
This is, for context, this is a kind of a master dog walker thinking about his career. He's very, very serious about it.
Go quick.
He no longer contracted with unreliable owners. If he had reason to suspect an owner or family was not prepared to keep a dog for its lifetime, he did not take the job. It could be difficult. Sometimes a dog owned by one of these irresponsible persons had powerful appeal, grace, sensitivity, and air of loneliness. But the risk was too great. He made himself walk away from these dogs.
The Master Dog Walker in Love and Infant Monkeys by Lydia Millett. And that's in your top few as well, Laura.
Yes, I love that collection. It's such an amazing mixture of the satirical and the sort of mysterious and eternal. It's just a tour de force.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking about great books of 09 and time for the holidays today. Laura Miller is with us from Salon.com. Carol Bessie from Carmichael's Bookstore in Louisville, Kentucky, chosen as Bookstore of the Year this year by Publishers Weekly. And from Palm Springs, California, we're joined by David Yulin. He's book editor for the Los Angeles Times. And in these electronic times, my dear readers, we have on Facebook, Valerie says, Jess Walter, Financial Lives of the Poets, Stieg Larsson, The Girl with the Dragon Tattoo, and Lisa C., Shanghai Girls, out of China. So there's just a few more from our listeners. Carol Bessie in Louisville, take us jump over to your nonfiction list for a second. What have you got up high there?
The top of my list in nonfiction is probably Michael Sandel's book called Justice. Hmm. And when I looked at the books that I had chosen in my both fiction and nonfiction, this sort of theme emerged that I'd never really noticed before. And a lot of them revolve around this theme of justice or morality that I believe needs to be returned to the conversation. And that's what Michael Sandel does. He's a professor at Harvard, professor of political philosophy. And he poses these very deep questions of morality that philosophers have fought with over the centuries, but he does it in the context of current affairs and issues that really gets students engaged and really gets the reader engaged in his book.
He packs
his
them
book
in
is
in
called
the
Justice, right? What's the Right Thing to Do? Mm. And many of us think we know what the right thing to do is, that it's, you know, right or wrong, I could decide. But he comes in and puts in all kinds of shades of gray.
He packs them in the lecture hall and makes the top of your list as well there. David Yulin, on the nonfiction side, what have you got?
I thought it was a superb year for nonfiction, so I've got a bunch of stuff, starting with William Volman's book Imperial, which I would describe as sort of the California equivalent of what Laura was talking about in terms of Lethem's novel. It's really it's a massive book like Volman's books tend to be, but don't let that put you off. It's 1,300 of the fastest pages you'll ever read. It's accessible in as much as he ever is accessible, but it deals with issues of immigration. It deals with water, which is really the defining issue of California, I think, and is increasingly going to become a defining issue in terms of world culture and conservation, and also kind of the mythic superstructure of culture and the landscape. It's beautiful and complicated, and really does kind of create a 21st century vision of California recasting a lot of what we consider to be classic issues out here, but which also has led to a kind of ossified way of thinking about them.
This is Imperial by William T. Voltman. I'm reading here, it's called A Huge, Intensely Personal Fever Dream About One of the Harshest but Most Contested Territories in North America, the desert borderlands of southeastern California and northern Mexico. He calls them Imperial. Sounds intense. Sounds great. What else have you got, David?
I also was quite impressed with Dave Cullen's book Columbine, which I think really sort of undercut or sliced through a lot of the myths that have surrounded the massacre at Columbine High School of 1999. I thought Lynn Sharon Schwartz's sort of very lovely and strange non-travel memoir, Not Now Voyager. It's a travel book by someone who avowedly hates to travel. which is my situation as well. And then just, I realize it's a dangerous thing to say to a Boston radio station, but Joe Torre's The Yankee Years were absolutely superb in ways that, you know, when the book came out, there was all that sort of buzz about just the kind of the gossipy stuff. But really in terms of, you know, if you're a baseball fan or even if you're not, in terms of really understanding management of personalities, the weird and, you know, culture of the New York Yankees and Torre's peculiar genius at managing egos and kind of zen-like detachment, it's really quite a good book, a book that kind of got written off as a sports book but deals with a lot more than just that.
We'll survive your recommendation. Joe Torre's The Yankee Years, written along with Tom Verducci. And I see you've got Ted Kuzier's Lights on a Ground of Darkness. We had him on not long ago. Wonderful, wonderful man and wonderful short book. Laura Miller, how about you on the nonfiction front?
Well, I think my number one pick is probably A New Literary History of America, which looks sort of like a reference book. The editors are Greil Marcus and Werner Solers. It's put out by Harvard University Press. It has 200 different entries, but its resemblance to a conventional reference book sort of stops there. It's really about American culture, and there are entries on Alcoholics Anonymous and the Winchester Rifle, in addition to Emily Dickinson and Walt Whitman and the usual things that you might expect. They're written by all kinds of people, you know, academics, critics, all of them really excellent writers, and you could read one of these entries every night before bed and come away just knowing so much more about the country and where we all sort of come from culturally. It's endlessly enlightening and exciting and full of discoveries. I just love that book.
Literary History of America, Greil Marcus and Werner Solers. I should say here, we'll put all these lists up at our website, On Point Radio, dear listeners, in case you miss any of these. Another, Laura?
Well, I also am a big fan of Dave Cullen's Columbine. And in a similar vein, there's a book called Tall Man by a woman named Chloe Hooper. She's an Australian writer. It's about the death in police custody of an Aboriginal man on this weird, remote, sort of tropical island where it's like Australia's Australia, where the Australians send the Aborigines who give them too much trouble. And it's just an amazing, kind of like Truman Capote-esque, sort of true crime, courtroom drama, reportage. It's just wonderful in the same sort of similar a tone as the Columbine book.
Do you have a little reading from Chloe Hooper's Tall Man?
I do indeed. Mm-hmm. This sort of is just a very brief. It's sort of hard to pick something that really gives you a sense of the whole sweep of this, but sort of sets the mood. Mm-hmm. And the person mentioned, Boa, in this is the head lawyer. He's like a crusading lawyer on behalf of the murdered man's family.
Okay.
The first night I spent on Palm Island, there was no moon. Cicadas tuned in and out of the heat. As it grew darker, I sat on the motel veranda drinking with the lawyers. Boa had the manner of someone lumbered with exchange students in a war zone. What have you learnt? He kept asking, wanting epiphanies.
No moon, cicadas, veranda, war zone, and a drink with lawyers. And right away, we know we're somewhere. We know we're somewhere. Let's turn to our listeners. A lot of them are calling in. Sarah in Boston, what's the top of your list this year, Sarah?
Hi, everybody. First of all, I just want to comment on something you said before about, you know, books as gifts, hardcover versus paperback. Mm-hmm. I love getting and giving books as gifts still. I hate reading things online. I love holding a book in my hand. I love keeping books. I love keeping them on my bookshelf, whether I've read them or not, and just sort of looking at them. I think they really, for better or for worse, really create an identity, and I just love giving books that I love to other people as gifts. So I'm still a big fan of that.
The book publishers of the world applaud you, Sarah. Yes, and Carol Bessie puts you on her shelf.
Nobody's paying me to say that.
Right. So what do you like, Sarah?
So this year I really loved Michael Chabon's book, Manhood for Amateurs,
yes.
The Pleasures and Regrets of a Husband, Father, and Son. I read his stuff before, and I believe this is his first sort of, work of personal essays, and I'm a big fan of narrative nonfiction. I think he does a great job of describing the ways that he parents and loves and his memories of his own childhood. I think it's funny and poignant at the same time, and it really made me want to just go buy it for literally every husband, father, and son that I know.
You want men to read it, and what do you want them to learn from it, Sarah?
You know, I think it's a great book of being honest about, you know, the challenges of your world. And he just put such a nice, again, you know, both funny and endearing spin on it that I think it's very accessible and easy to relate to, both for men and women. I mean, as a woman myself, I believe that I will never be a husband, a father, or a son, but I still found it captivating and very well written. So I think it's accessible for anybody, and I think it's easy to relate to.
Bravo. Michael Chabon's Manhood for Amateurs. Thank you very much. Let's get a call from Buffalo, New York, and Catherine. Catherine, you're on the air. What are you reading?
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm reading a book by Jane Gardam called The Man in the Wooden Hat. Jane Gardam is an English writer who is in her 80s now, and she's been quite prolific, and she has an amazing body of work. And it's a sequel to a book called Old Filth. Both books are about the story of a marriage between two adults who were orphans, sort of Raj orphans.
Mm-hmm.
And their life goes between Hong Kong and England, and it's just beautifully written. And the other thing I was going to say that Sarah mentioned was, I love to hold a book too, and this book is wonderful. It's a Europa edition. It's a paperback, but it has those extended sort of fly leaves that you can use as a placeholder.
Oh yeah, you're really into the physical there.
There's something, you know, wonderful, you know, very well designed, very simple about the book itself too.
Good to read.
I just wanted to promote Jane Gardam because I think she's an amazing writer, and I just hope she gets better known in the United States before she dies.
That's great. Jane Gardam's The Man in the Wooden Hat, good to read, good to hold. David Hewlin, how about those choices from our listeners?
I think those are good choices. I like Michael's work quite a lot, and I think he's I love his fiction. I think his nonfiction is quite lovely. He did a book a couple years ago, the name of which will now escape me, but it was a collection of essays that McSweeney's did about sort of his love of genre fiction, which is also a lovely work of kind of narrative / critical nonfiction. If you want to pursue his nonfiction further, I haven't read the latest Gardam, although I thought Old Filth was a lovely book. And those Europa books, I think they also have those deckled edges, you know, the rough pages, which
right.
I'm also a devotee of the physical book.
we've got the full tactile experience here. Here from the web, Sam says he's been reading Losing Mom and Pup. That was the memoir from Christopher Buckley. Quite surprisingly, he says one of the better books he's read in a while. And also from Purnima Lowboy by John Ray, about a superb tale about a schizophrenic teen, she says. Carol Bessie, you've got more creatures on your list. The Elegance, you had Little Bean, and The Elegance of the Hedgehog by Muriel Barbary. Tell us about that.
Well, interestingly enough, The Elegance of the Hedgehog is another Europa edition that we were just describing, and it is a lovely book to hold in your hand. Europa editions are some of those original paperbacks I talked about that are bringing European writers to the attention of Americans. And this one by Muriel Barbary, who is French, and this was a bestseller in Europe. It's just a lovely little book.
Got a reading?
I do. From The Elegance of the Hedgehog. Human longing. We cannot cease desiring, and this is our glory and our doom. Desire. It carries us and crucifies us, delivers us every new day to a battlefield where, on the eve, The battle was lost.
Oh, that's wonderfully French somehow. I'll take it. I'll take it. That's
it great. Has been surprisingly accepted well over here, even though it is set in France and by a French writer. But it's really just a lovely little book with some just compelling characters.
The Elegance of the Hedgehog by Muriel Barbary. Susan in Farmville, Virginia. Susan, you're on the air.
Great. Hello. I would like to recommend Luis Urrea's Into the Beautiful North, contemporary Mexican-American author, maybe best known for The Hummingbird's Daughter. This is a great book. It is funny. It is very touching, and it's a very useful corrective to most Americans' views of what's going on in contemporary Mexico.
And what's the main thing we'll learn about what's going on correctively, Susan?
That young people in Mexico want to save Mexico. They don't want to live in the United States.
Ah, terrific. Into the Beautiful North with a message about Mexico right there. Susan, thanks for your call. Laura Miller, take us on down your fiction list, if you would, here. We got Chronic City. Dive in a little deeper.
Okay. Well, I could have almost put the entire Booker Prize short list on my best of list because there were three amazing novels by British women on that list. I didn't put Wolf Hall on my five best list because it won the prize, but it was really neck and neck with the children's book by A.S. Byatt, which is about a bunch of people in the Edwardian era, like the early 20th century, who are part of the arts and crafts movement, who do things like write children's fiction or put on stage sort of puppet shows, and who are also social utopians. And it starts out with this idyllic production of The Midsummer Night's Dream in the English countryside, and then gradually you learn the sort of less idyllic things about these various interlocking families that run through the book. But one of the things that I really love about A.S. Byatt is the way that she writes about people who are driven creatively. And there are several characters like this in the book that are just possessed with the desire to make something beautiful. And I feel like no one writes better about that than she does.
Sounds great. Do you have a snippet for us?
I do. One of my favorite characters in the book is a working class boy who has been working in a pottery factory, and he just comes into this sort of middle class milieu saying, "I want to make a pot." And he just can't express what he wants to do, but he's completely obsessed with sort of art ceramics. And this is what happens when he sees the first really beautiful pot of his life.
Yeah.
"It was a large earthenware vessel that bellied out and curved in again to a tall neck with a fine lip. The glaze was silver gold with veilings of aquamarine. The light flowed round the surface like clouds reflected in water. This was what he had come to look for. His fingers moved inside its contours on an imaginary wheel. Its form clothed his sense of the shape of his body. He stood stock still and stared."
From the children's book by A.S. Byatt. Wow, he is truly captivated by that bit of pottery.
Yes, and the descriptions, I mean, she's sort of known for all of the sort of information, historical information in her books. But for me, what always wins me over is just these ravishing descriptions of the countryside, of flowers, and just of this pottery that this kid and his mentor makes, and just how they go to the ocean and they try to make the same glaze on the pots that they can see of the light reflecting on the ocean. It's just wonderful.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour at the outset of the holidays here about great books of 2009. David Ulan, I see on your fiction list, you've got a couple of sort of, I guess poetry belongs right there, and you've also got the Book of Genesis from R. Crumb. We weren't sure what list to put that one on. I guess that's in a divine category of its own. But first, Usher Poems. This is from B.H. Fairchild. I know you don't have it right there, but I have just a little reading. This is from one entry in B.H. Fairchild's collection of poems called Usher. This is from the top of The Gray Man. I'll read, "We are cutting weeds and sunflowers on the shoulder, the gray man and I, red dust coiling up around us, muddying our sweat-smeared mugs, clogging our hair, the iron heel of an August Kansas sun pushing down on the scythes we raise against it and swing down in an almost homicidal rage and drunken weariness. From the Gray Man in this collection of poems, Usher, I guess we hear what took us.
I actually have a couple of lines from it here.
Please.
The beauty of the computer. And the one that, this is a guy who has, you know, just is a brilliant, meaty kind of poet. You know, he writes, there's just a lot of stuff to chew on in his poetry. And in one of the poems here, he describes the poem called Frida Pushnik, which is narrated by an armless, legless circus freak. He has this little couplet, which just sort of sums up my worldview, perhaps. A minister once told me to embrace my sorrow. To hell with that, I said, embrace your own. It's kind of relentless and ruthless, this stuff, and it's a corrective to anyone who, you know, all the people who were taught poetry badly in high school and taught that it was somehow, you know, ethereal or inaccessible or not relevant to the concerns of daily living ought to take a look at this book and, frankly, all of Fairchild's stuff. He's just one of the best we have.
Usher, Poems by B.H. Fairchild, and also R. Crumb, the cartoonist, visual artist. His Book of Genesis makes your list.
Yeah, I think this is a really terrific piece of work for a couple of reasons. One is, I mean, you know, I actually write a fair amount about cartoonists and graphic novelists, and Crumb is obviously one of the sort of protean figures of kind of contemporary cartooning or graphic novelry as literature or art. What's really interesting about this book is that, you know, he has illustrated the Book of Genesis. He has not messed with the text at all. He used a kind of combination of the King James Bible and the recent Robert Alter translation from the Five Books of Moses. And so that, you know, so that the text is the classic text. One of the things he writes about in the introduction is that when you look at Bible comics, the text is always altered. And what he was interested in doing, and parenthetically, I should say, interested in doing as a non-believer, was to take the original text and illustrate the story. And what he's ended up doing in that regard is really kind of returning us to the human story rather than the sacred story, or actually making sacred the human story. We all sort of know the stories of Genesis, but to be confronted with them again, kind of taken out of the context of religion and just looking at them in terms of narrative with these very kind of Crummian illustrations, is to really face the kind of, these are the elemental stories of kind of the Western narrative tradition.
Sort of read it again.
To me, it returns the Bible to us, to people, which is something that I think we could really stand.
Read it again, see it again for the first time. His story is so elemental that they end up crossing back, at least in my reading, to the sacred quite potently. Robert in Norfolk, Virginia. Robert, you're on the air.
Hey, Tom.
What are you reading, Robert? What are you recommending?
Oh, right in line. I feel partly pseudo-Crummian. I was recommending Bart Ehrman's book, Jesus Interrupted.
Jesus Interrupted? Tell us about it. I don't know it.
Oh, yeah. Well, Bart Ehrman's the professor of religious studies, I believe, down at the University of North Carolina in Chapel Hill. He's
great.
The author of Misquoting Jesus, God's Problem, several of them. But this one by far has been my favorite. I'm also an agnostic. Questioner more than anything else, and the book has been like going to a mini seminary school for me.
So
I'm giving it to all of my evangelical friends this year, although they're probably, I don't know what they're going to do to me.
There you go, an education and an inspiration. Thank you, Robert. And Karen in Essex, Massachusetts. Karen, what's on your list?
Hi. I coordinate a book group for international donors and funders, and a very hot book in our circle is Half the Sky by Nicholas Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. And I highly recommend it because I believe it's a pioneering, even historic book that is going to fuel a movement for women's empowerment around the world. And it's brilliantly written because he interweaves the stories of individual women with dire statistics. But you're pulled into the book because the stories of these women are so hopeful. And he tells, and Cheryl tells, how just a little bit of investment in their lives lifts their whole communities and their societies.
Half the Sky, as in Women Holding Up Half the Sky, by Nick Kristof and Cheryl Wu Dunn. Thank you very much for that, Karen. And one more right here, Waterbury, Connecticut. Peter, you're on the air.
Hello there. I'm reading Stuart Brand's Whole Earth Discipline. Stuart Brand was the editor and founder of the Whole Earth Catalog.
Sure.
And he's always, as far as I'm concerned, on the edge. I've considered myself a relatively knowledgeable person, but he's definitely challenged me and probably changed my mind on nuclear energy as well as genetically engineered food. And I'm going to give this book to everybody that I possibly can this season.
Yeah, we talked with him just a couple of weeks ago. I mean, he's always a bracing thinker, and I found him that way again. Not every environmentalist will like all of his prescriptions.
But, that's for sure.
But you're right. He makes you think it from the ground up one more time. And thank you very much for that, Peter. Carol Bessie, take us back to your nonfiction list. You have T.R. Reid, who public radio listeners may remember from his many columns some years back, The Healing of America. I haven't read it. What is it, Carol?
It is subtitled A Global Quest for Better, Cheaper, and Fairer Health Care. And, you know, I chose this book not only because it's timely, but because it really does a great job of taking this debate about health care and making it accessible and understandable to anyone who will take the time to read it. He did all kinds of research all across the world not just European countries, but a variety of countries, and studied their healthcare systems and came to lots of interesting conclusions. But in the end, he says this debate should start with the moral choice. And the debate has not really been framed correctly. Is there a universal right to health care? Almost every country in the world has said yes. The United States has not. And until we say that, we'll really never get anywhere reforming of health care.
Well,
so it's a very timely book. It's very well done, and I hope a lot of people will take the time to read it.
Very timely. T.R. Reid's The Healing of America. And from your nonfiction list, Laura, take us a little further. We've got Greil Marcus' Literary History of America. You've got Age of Wonder by Richard Holmes. Tell us about
yeah.
it.
Now, Richard Holmes is this British biographer, and honestly, this guy could probably write about tax law and make it thrilling. But he generally picks more interesting subjects. Usually, he's known for writing biographies of the Romantic poets in the period of the early 1800s. But Age of Wonder is about scientists. It's about astronomers and biologists and explorers, and it's about the intersection of the kind of great romantic impulse, which is of, you know, the expansion of the human imagination and of our capacity to dream through the sciences. It's people who traveled, the first Englishman to go to Tahiti and how he studied the culture there, and an astronomer named William Herschel who worked in the town of Bath and who created these enormous, beautiful telescopes so that people could see further into the cosmos than they had ever before, and who discovered the planet Uranus and kind of inspired all of this poetry. So it's about the intersection of science and art in the early 19th century, and it's just endlessly fascinating and inspiring.
Sounds great. Worth reading now. I'm trying to grab onto, again, maybe Age of Wonder by Richard Holmes. Age of Wonder, How the Romantic Generation Discovered the Beauty and Terror of Science, sort of the romantic imagination, not alienated, but inspired by scientific advances. Anthony in Buffalo, New York. You're on the air, Anthony.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much. Sure. I'm one of these bibliophiles. I love books, too. Hold them, smell them. And I have a recommendation of an author, a very interesting fellow, who writes both in the scientific field and also novels in fiction field.
Okay.
And in the scientific field, he's written a number of books, one of which is an Oxford book called Intelligent Movement Machine. He does work on brain functions.
Give us the name, Anthony. Who is this? Who is this great writer?
The writer's name is Graziano, Michael S. A. Graziano. He's at Princeton. He's a neuroscientist, but he also writes in fiction, and it's the fiction that I just wanted to point out to you because he's much less known for that. He's known in his scientific field.
Give us some titles.
Yeah, two of them I want to tell you about. One is called The Love Song of Monkey.
Okay. Monkeys are big today.
The Love Song of Monkey. The other one is called The Divine Farce, obviously taken from, Dante.
And are these science fiction or what, Anthony?
Yeah, I'm sorry. Say it again, Tom. Sorry.
Science fiction or...
No, I don't know how you would characterize these. They are different. If your listeners want something different, look at these two books. They're very brief. They are actually a one-night read, except that you keep putting it down and looking up at the ceiling and thinking about what he said, so it takes you more than a night. What? And he puts people into these bizarre situations, and then he examines the relationship. And I'll give you just one example very quickly, and I won't tell you more about it. One of the heroes ends up walking across the bottom of the Atlantic Ocean from the United States to Europe. Now, you visualize that.
I cannot say been there, done that.
You visualize what the UN. It's Kafkaesque. It's very, very different.
Michael Graziano with The Love Song of Monkey and Divine Farce. Anthony, thanks very much for that. We've got on Twitter here, we've got Rachel in New York City recommending Goat Song by Brad Kessler. She says it's the best book I read this year. And, I'm right on board with that. We talked with Brad on this show. Absolutely wonderful book about raising goats and making cheese in Vermont. Just terrific. Leslie in Fort Myers, Florida. What have you got, Leslie?
Yes, I'm recommending Pat Conroy's South Abroad.
If you like Pat Conroy, it's a nice big book of the South. We had him on as well and had a lot of fun talking about it. Did you get caught up in it, Leslie?
I did. I found it characters very compelling. I love the way it went back and forth in time with the friendship, the circle of friends, and went out from Charleston out to San Francisco. It was very compelling, wonderful, beautiful Southern prose once again by one of my favorites.
Absolutely. He always brings his passion game. No question. Pat Conroy, South Abroad. Let's get a call from Los Angeles. And Sod, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I would like to know what is Tom Ashbrook's best nonfiction read of the year.
Ooh.
And I would like to recommend also Con Coughlin's Khomeini's Ghost. It's an excellent biography. He's an excellent biographer. But it also traces the development of the nuclear program in Iran from the days of the Shah until the present day.
Con Coughlin's Khomeini's Ghost. Well, on my list, it is such a tall stack. I mean, the reading that gets done for this show is so voluminous, but one that really touched me this year, nonfiction, and David, I see it's on your list, was Ted Kuger's Lights on a Ground of Darkness, a small book, a memoir of family in old Iowa, but wherever you're from, I just found it incredibly moving and sensitive book, David.
It's a beautiful book, and it's, as you say, it's very short. The structure of it's gorgeous. The whole thing is built around a single night in 1949 when the author's a kid and his grandmother has invited the family over for an evening of cards. And then he moves back and forth through time and really addresses and kind of, in an utterly unsentimental way, reconciles himself to sort of loss and aging and finds meaning in all that kind of transitory nature of things. It's exquisite. I really can't recommend it highly enough.
We had tremendous response to that conversation with Ted Kuger, Lights on a Ground of Darkness. Carol Bessie, our time begins to grow short. Give us one more reading, if you would, from, I see, Empire of Illusion on your list. What is it? And read just a bit for us.
Empire of Illusion is kind of a screed by Chris Hedges, who's a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Mm-hmm. The subtitle is The End of Literacy and the Triumph of Spectacle. And he uses things like professional wrestling and pornography and reality television to demonstrate that our society is pretty much on the verge of collapse, in his opinion.
Read before our clock goes away from us, Carol.
Okay. He ends the book with this quote. Power elites have for millennia tried and failed to crush the force of love. Blind and dumb, indifferent to the siren calls of celebrity, unable to bow before illusions, defying the lust for power, love constantly rises up to remind a wayward society of what is real and what is illusion. Love will endure, even if it appears darkness has swallowed us all, to triumph over the wreckage that remains. That is actually the last line of the book.
Empire.
So he redeems himself in the end.
It will triumph. Chris Hedges, An Empire of Illusion. Our time grows very short. One more, The Little Stranger by Sarah Waters, Laura. What puts it on your list?
This is one of the greatest ghost stories I have ever read. It it takes the classic gothic novel, which is usually about a woman in a house who's kind of neurotic, and usually the ghost has something to do with repressed sexuality and resentments. And she applies it to something completely different, which is class relations in post-war England. It's both very creepy and totally new, and also completely classic, a great cozy page-turning read. A masterpiece.
If you've got my attention, The Little Stranger yeah. by Sarah Waters, just terrific. We will put the full lists of all of our guests today up at our website, onpointradio.org, and we're so grateful to each of you. Carol Bessie at Carmichael's Bookstore in Louisville, Kentucky. Carol, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you, Tom. It was fun.
David Ulan in Palm Springs with the Los Angeles Times. David, thanks for being here.
My pleasure, Tom. I really had a great time.
And Laura Miller, book critic with Salon.com. Thank you so much, Laura.
Thank you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. Happy reading. This is On Point.